welcome to the Red Rabbit Podcast. I am your host, Ticket Hickory. In this season of the Red Rabbit Podcast, we will be listening to Book 1 of W.H. Ellingsworth's The Endless Falling of Dreams book series. So without further ado, the Red Rabbit Podcast proudly presents W.H. Ellingsworth's The Endless Falling of Dreams, Book 1, Orthodoxy. Fare thee well, brave travelers. Episode 2, The Uncreated, Part 1. Fex turned back into the sanctuary of the trees. He kept his eyes off his wife, who now cried silently for the distant confetti. He knew she didn't know a single person on that ship. It would have been impossible. But he didn't say this, and walked to her and gently stroked her hair. Perhaps they were lucky that captured uncreated were never purged, as the Vayer deemed them unworthy of such a dignity. The Vayer thought the Vindicator was too kind. Purging was said to bring purification. The Vayer made sure that when uncreated were killed, their executions were done in a way that prevented any type of dignity. And while the threat of being fed to the machines was as terrible as being stuffed inside the Vindicator, to the young couple, many like them, it seemed less imposing than being led aboard that horrible, flying, metal maggot. The fire frightened them the most. Those flames that rose constantly in the background of every Vayerian child's nightmares. Besides, no one had ever seen a machine actually snatch up a heretic. However, Fex shuddered at the thought of even standing within a mile of that ship. As for the hope of redemption, Fex had long ago given up such Vayerian propaganda and dogma, and was much more concerned with living. He scratched at his hair, which knotted around his fingers as he tugged at it, before he turned back toward his wife, careful not to make eye contact with her. He motioned her forward. The girl followed after him tiredly, dragging her feet like stones. Her legs felt depleted. He thought of words to say to her, but this was never easy, since they long existed in a world without decent conversation. Sure, they could still speak, but the words fell like broken notes from a cracked instrument. In their new world, words were spoken only for basic purposes and orders, and rarely, if ever, for communicating any type of deep feeling. Still, there were times when some would still feel inclined to try, perhaps for the sake of the past, but perhaps more out of the sake of some instinctual, unexplainable human desire. But the Imperium had robbed them of speech. I think we need to go, he stammered out. Embarrassed by the clunky smattering of his speech, he couldn't understand why he could think so clearly and yet couldn't get a word of it out. I know. Are you sad? He stayed quiet and looked at him, searching for his eyes. He made sure they eluded hers. Nothing can be done. No changing it. Facts. No, Re. Sorry. He said, holding up his hand toward her as he walked deeper into the forest. No mourning. I must. No. Facts, she said strongly, her tears fading back. We must mourn, so others mourn for us. No one will. They looked at each other tensely, as if in battle. The boy, stopping to turn toward her, he took a deep breath though, his eyes now finding hers with the familiar consequences. I'm sorry. We don't talk anymore. I know. But they take away, we make worse. We make things more difficult. I'm sorry. He walked over to her and pressed her thin shoulders against his chest, letting her hair tickle the skin around his mouth. I don't want to just hide. I know. X. She paused after looking up at him, her eyes wide and strained. Her dirty face beamed from the shine of the moon, and it looked, underneath it, as if the clumps of dirt were merely freckles. I'm with a child. I want her to live and grow, be more than this. How will she? She must. She moved within inches of him, so he could see the strength in her words and the terseness of her body. Hilo felt no such terseness in his, and she found sympathy in the sunken curve of his shoulders. She moved close to him again and embraced him under the moon. They fell asleep outside their cave a few hours after the purging activities, the girl's head resting against the boy's thin chest. It was purely accidental, and when the dawn suns woke them both in the morning, they hurried back down into their cave, looking for any signs of trackers. Even if the army paid relatively little attention to them, because if they really wanted to, they could have eradicated all of the uncreated by simply destroying the mountains or performing a clean sweep of the caves. They still weren't safe. They'd seen individuals captured by the trackers. Most of those caught had given into a wild hopelessness. This wildness stayed with him, driving his thoughts inevitably toward his own family. He'd contemplate both of them. He'd wonder if either of them would fall into such recklessness. And unable to think of such thoughts for long, he turned his attention back to preventing their detection. As Rhi stood up, covering her shoulders with her tattered red shroud, Vex motioned to her sternly. She grimaced at him and wearily sat down on a large rock while she yawned and looked around slowly. There were no smells of oil or jet fuel, nor was there the high-pitched sounds the tracking ship's lasers made before aiming. She had grown familiar with such signs, to the extent that noticing them became instinctual. He motioned again, his muscles tightening so that his forehead filled with the cascade of veins that sort of matched the curls on his head. He checked the tree lines for the glowing red eyes of the tracking ship's spotlights. She stayed on the rock. She put her right hand against her belly and looked up at him. Despite his nervousness and the threatening air the morning sky always took on after a purging, he let them subdue him. The two remained in the forest for some time, two people with their births reversed and negated by the society that created them, now fretting alone on a mountaintop, forced to consider the judgment of a world they were never given time to understand. The girl's hand stretched across her stomach, held the two together like a shared wound, until a roaring airship flew above them and woke them. They dashed back out of sight. Far from them, inside the temple, where purging orders were given and the lover's judgment decreed, the brethren had worked through the night. Before he had retired to his quarters the evening prior, Sextus said he wanted the war with the ICA over by the end of the month. Now they were busy with semantics. Purging decisions had to be made. People assimilated. Directions and doctrines written out for the generals. All the while, ships and fleets rumbled above them. The council had taken one break, and it didn't seem one would be forthcoming. As it stood, several more planets were on the verge of falling to Vyaire. There weren't many left, and complete and utter victory was an inevitability. When his Imperium re-entered the hall, he had already seemed angry. He impatiently picked and his fine hair, which was smoothly and carefully combed, and his blue eyes marched coldly up and down the room. Everyone stood up to greet him, but did so without uttering a word. The chamber was always dark. The floors and walls were all black marble. There were statues of the various patriarchs of the Sextus houses, and next to these, iron sculptures of martyrs kissing the feet of the current Imperium. The brethren sat on chairs arranged on gradually rising steps, leading right up to his Imperium's throne. The walls of the room, like those in the temples, were about 100 feet tall, and behind Sextus' throne was a remarkably large stained glass recreation of his Imperium's assured victory. This was articulated by a crowd of ugly people, their faces contorted like ghouls, staring up at a darkened sky. The crowd stared upward and kept their face off the strange, monstrous hands that reached up from the ground and grabbed at their ankles. Above the crowd was an army of faceless figures carrying swords and torches who stood on the deck of a fleet of mighty boats. Sextus's throne was arranged so that he seemed to sit at the front of this military horde. He scratched his back as the priests and clerics bowed under him. His face was immediately both handsome and severe. "Brethren," he said, his deep, crisp voice rattling off the walls. It was then that an old man, one of his Imperium's personal counselors, came running through the doors, his head covering slipping down past the back of his neck. The other brethren gasped at the display, and the soldiers who lined the walls of the room stepped forward quickly toward him. He stopped immediately after the door shut and breathed heavily as his pale face contorted and he reached for air like a half-drowned madman. "Our Imperium, I apologize for my brazenness," the man said between intermittent gasps. "It's important news, my Supreme." He held his hand against his cleanly shaven head. "Speak," Sextus commanded. "It's the prison Imperium, our Imperium. There are snakes amongst us, vipers in the grass we could not see," the man said, his mouth now curling up fiercely and violently as he kept rubbing his head.
"What has happened?"
Sextus's voice remained deep and calm, and if not for the narrowing of his blue eyes, no one would be able to detect the slightest trace of alarm.
"Most of the prisoners have gone missing, Lord. Most of them from the Order of the Orthodoxy. They were in captivity at the Ultramon, waiting for examination, but now..."
The man's eyes jolted, and the left one, which had been physically altered during his techno trial, turned blood red. "Something aided them, killing our men, our Imperium. Our brethren slaughtered like beasts, and now the seditionists are gone." The council began to murmur as their faces scowled and gasped in horror. Sextus, however, kept his statue-like countenance before finally raising his hand. The council stilled. The Order of the Orthodoxy was a separatist movement within the Empire that had been the only real threat to his Imperium for some time. So far, Sextus had managed to keep the full magnitude of this threat a secret, despite the Order's growing influence and power. The Order had infiltrated every level of his Empire and sought independence from his Imperium and complete loyalty to the great machine Orthodoxy.
"This is heresy, tradition of the highest putridity in our kingdom, even here, under the grace of your Imperium, there is disloyalty to that which is pure. When did the attack on Prison Theotremon take place?
We're not sure. It must have been planned for months. Our Imperium, the terrorists of people inside your house.
Sextus's eyes grew fierce, and he took a deep breath before closing them.
My guess is if the prisoners were to escape, this was indeed something our own aided in, and the prisoners took refuge amongst the uncreated.
We must purge, a middle-aged priest yelled. His hair and eyes matched his Imperium's, only without the same finesse. And when he spoke, his deeply poured nose turned a blistering red. Others quickly imitated him.
Silence, brethren. Though what you say is true, the heretics must have taken to the hills of the uncreated, and therefore must still be located amongst them.
The Imperium's chin bowed, the pale skin on his neck plumping and folding under it.
We must purge the heathen animal.
But my Imperium...
One young cleric's voice rose up amongst the resulting tumult. He was short, with deep brown eyes and straw hair that laid listlessly over his youthful, chubby face.
Up until now, the Sacred Council has practiced restraint against the uncreated. The people, they see this as an act of compassion and mercy. This has immeasurably helped their trust in you. This provides them a visible reminder of our, well, a gentler side of our provisions, my Imperium. I fear a purging of the uncreated could waylay our people's trust.
It is the dichotomy of people, the nature of human frailty, that desires what is paradoxical. To want the cold and the fire, the love of the heart and the wrath of the protective hand. People must be led, not listened to, in these most base reactions.
The middle-aged cleric countered.
But brethren, the young priest said, I believe that to do so could hurt our favor in the eyes of many. People must believe and trust in our council, not live entirely in fear of it.
These matters are great. No decision we make is easy. But our interest is never in the political swaying of men, and is solely invested in the well-being of Vyar.
Sextus said slowly, invitingly, his lips curling as his whole body clenched fierce.
The heathen dog has entered our courtyard, and the young pups we have let graze at our gates evaded his entry. What must be done now is a matter of utmost sanctity, and not a deliberation on ethics. Pathies and empathies have no place amongst this council as we carry on. Not according to currying favor. We crave no favor. Ours is a way of absolution, not pandering. Remove him, soldiers. Remove this young priest from my temple and sentence him to Persia at once. I'd like an immediate tribunal set up to investigate his appointment, as well as who recommended him for such an office. He is so clearly even now, the war quickens and grows thicker. Do not take the strength of your Imperium and all assured victory as an opportunity for gross haughtiness and irreverence.
sinners. This seditionist represents a direct threat to that end.
Sextus's veined face now fully revealed his rage. He stared at his audience again with marching eyes. Once out of the stupor his Imperium's yelling produced, three soldiers quickly converged onto the young dissenter and dragged him out of the room as he begged and pled for the same mercy he tried to extend to the uncreated.
Our people stand at the cusp of our greatest victory, and we allow the sniveling dog into our house and then pontificate mercy on his behalf. The disease of the entire sea of blood and flesh has reached our walls, as it has before, and this council must not tarry in our judgments or our resolve. It is time to carry out judgment against the uncreated and fulfill the decree placed upon them by that name. The prisoners must be retrieved or killed. The fact that they were freed is all the evidence we need. Oh, my friends, the threat is great, and so our resolve shall be also.
The entire council cheered. The decree was officially made, and the already gathered fleet readied for the immediate execution of the order.
But unto other matters, children. There is a great matter of which demands pronouncement from his Imperium.
What is that, his Imperium? The council asked.
It is the matter of the machines.
The gods who serve you?
That is the matter that demands his Imperium to set precedent. There has been much conjecture on the matter, and confusion. Years of gossip has confounded this matter further, and thereby misleading the inhabitants of this his Imperium's domain and causing untold plague, and as so fit to weigh upon this matter as protector, leader, and Imperium of this Vihair Empire, and guided as always by mine own love for this my empire, do hereby declare that henceforth the machines will not be mislabeled any further. Let not machine be confused with gods, and let nothing be confused with the mighty throne of his Imperium. Let his Imperium be heard.
His Imperium is heard! The Orthodoxy is dead! Forever live his Imperium!
The council cheered in violent chorus. When the chanting subsided, the same middle-aged priest rose his hand.
How dare the machine steal credit belonging only unto you? May we strike against them next!
No need, brethren. The mistake was not theirs, and instead the fault of idle tongues, which so reveals why we must be firm. As the machines only speak to his Imperium, I can assure you they've never asked for such titles. In fact, let it be known that his Imperium has never spoke of them as such.
This was, of course, a blatant lie. But in Vihair, the needle of every compass pointed in the direction of Sextus's words. Back on the mountains, the young uncreated could know nothing of the order or the discussion that followed. They finally left their cave after hiding for some time, but crept out carefully, walking quietly and quickly under the dark sky. Rhi could sense her husband's fondness for her growing under the approaching starlight. He kept looking in short bursts. When he didn't think she could see him, she pounced on this and grabbed his hand. They had not spoken about her child for hours. The boy was too afraid to even look at her, if she so much as glanced at her stomach or made a motion toward it. But now, as they walked and watched the stars begin to poke their heads through the evening sky, noticing for the first time the great many ships standing above them, she felt herself reaching for her belly while his hand stayed locked into hers. And when she finally rested her tiny fingers against her thin navel, she saw his eyes, though obscured by the night, unmistakably dart toward her belly. She stopped and pretended to feel pain, catching his concern for her womb like a bird in a trap.
"Are you okay?"
His voice was even clumsier than usual, the thoughts racing faster than his poor mouth could possibly process. He led her to a tree stump and sat her down as he gently wiped her hair. The girl smiled at him and softly pulled him forward, kissing his lips. He smiled and rubbed her hair again.
"Vex, I want her."
She paused to point to her womb.
"To live and be more than this."
"I know."
"Vex, I want us to live. We can't live, only to survive. Not only."
"I know," he interrupted her calmly. He sighed and cradled her head against his chest and looked up. The fleet practically covered the moons, and now he noticed how closely it gathered around the hills and the trees he and his wife clung to. They made his heart race. He only had one specific form of knowledge. There was only one thing he knew how to do. Survive. Now the entirety of this knowledge filled his head and made him feel so weary he nearly tumbled.
"She will be our child. She will be us. And when we are gone, when we are uncreated, she will keep going."
"Wife. My wife. You speak beautifully." He looked down at her with glassy eyes, unable to hide his fear. He put his hand on the back of her head and watched the smattering crowd of uncreated move out toward the end of the forest to watch the great ships.
"What is it?"
"Is the baby." He paused to collect his thoughts.
"If we can live, we must leave now, to the Valley of the Otterman. The gods will kill us."
"Maybe. But it is the only way. They say escape is there."
"If you survive the beasts."
"Yes. But here, the ships are worse than the beasts," he said, pointing to the fleet that now hid the night sky. Seeing the fear in her husband's eyes and the swarming cloud above her, the girl nodded swiftly and followed her husband back to their cave. There they gathered what little supplies they had, a cloth of near-rotten fruit and two canteens of water, and headed off for the valley underneath the mountain range. The uncreated long ago, as the myths were told, built a rudimentary bridge for any who so desired to take down the side of the mountain toward the valley of the Otterman. The bridge looked like nothing more than a series of loosely connected wood planks attached to long ropes and required the travelers to jump across large gaps in less than safe conditions, all while hanging thousands of feet in the air. The origins of the bridge were much debated, and a legend was born that one of the uncreated in ancient times was actually a half-god woman whose power frightened the council. Upon freeing herself from imprisonment and escaping to the mountains, the woman built the bridge to not only help herself, but all the uncreated. She was the only one who ever survived the trek through the valley of Theotrimit, the place where freedom was rumored to be possible if you could escape the gods. Any who dared remove the bridge were warned of facing her wrath, something that apparently concerned even Sextus. The bridge proved to be the only real way to the valley, since the mountains on that side stood remarkably straight rather than sloping, and rose up in rocky, jagged cliffs that would otherwise have to be climbed by hand. The Valley of Theotrimon was named after one of Romulus's ancestors, who was said to be in charge of judging those found irreverent. It was a forbidden place where the orthodoxy supposedly gathered. Being that the legend struck fear even into the most experienced soldiers, the valley stood relatively unguarded, deep under the protection of clouds and propaganda. The rumors kept infrastructure away from the valley, which made practical sense as well, since it was situated between another winding mountain range. The valley was essentially barren. There were no city skyscrapers or roads or busy airways filled with ships or the like. The only thing there, besides the stories, was dirt, rock, and the seven dead suns. And this is what Sextus preferred. The Imperium had practical reasons for spreading the rumors about gods in the valley. With a proper dosage of fear, the Imperium did not have to waste any unnecessary manpower. It did not matter that there was a rickety old bridge on the side of the mountain. With the threat of the gods, no one would dare ever use it. And more importantly, he, unlike his father, would not be embarrassed by endless questions about the infernal seven dead suns. The young boy and girl walked for at least 2 hours by the time they reached the cliff. They hesitated as they stared over the sharp ridge down to the sea of white mist and cloud below them, rocks jettisoned out of the side of the mountains like extended arthritic fingers. Alongside the rock, the bridge's wobbly planks could be seen. The bridge took on the magnitude of something prophetic and sacred. Rhi stepped on the wood first, clutching the side of the mountain in her womb as she walked across the swaying bridge. The wood creaked and whined with each step. Between the planks, they saw ground, small and distant like ants. They walked slowly. Sweat filled their palms. At points, they thought about stopping, but the ships began buzzing more furiously behind them. Vex wondered what they were doing. He knew it couldn't be good. He tried to hide his suspicion from Rhi. But his wife was smart. He wouldn't be able to fool her. After slipping past the soft gray clouds blanketing the valley and dividing it from the mountaintops, they found themselves able to move more quickly. They pressed forward. Most of the gaps weren't so bad, and the worst ones only required a longer stride to overtake. The bridge stabilized after about a mile or so. They reached the bottom in a day, rather than the days Vex expected. Vex counted he and his wife lucky, not only for the bridge, but that they didn't live on one of the taller mountains. Vaer's great warships waited with anticipation. They now took war formation over the mountains. Rhi and Vex couldn't see them. The great mist covered the sky, but they certainly heard them. It would be impossible not to. The ships roared, their engines screaming and echoing all the way down the mountain. When the two reached the ground, the girl stepped from the bridge first. Vex followed. His eyes searched deeply into the clouds above, which now began to finally break and reveal the fading stars. As before, standing as barriers between him and the sky were the terrible ships. Their engines roared and blazed with great frenetic force before the clouds covered them again. "It is this way," she said, pointing out to the barren valley of mostly cracked dirt and rock. Her husband dawdled behind her, his legs still unsteady from the wobbly bridge. He was ashamed. He felt so small next to his wife. And so Fex, terribly warm under the hot morning air of the valley, followed his wife as she took his hand and led him toward where the seven dead sons rested clearly, as if in a dream.
Thank you for listening to the Red Rabbit Podcast. I am your host, Ticket Hickory, reminding you to always listen and watch carefully. Until next time, brave travelers.